Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome to my podcast, I Shouldn't Say This, But. My name is Katie Leeson and I'm Managing Director of Social Chain UK. I'm sure a lot of you will have heard of Olio, but for those who haven't, Olio is an app that exists to connect neighbours with each other and to local businesses so that surplus food can be shared, not thrown away. Today, I will be talking with Olio CEO and co-founder Tessa Clark. I wanted to speak to Tessa because I know how passionate she is about starting a business, fundraising, and also making a change for society and the planet. Tessa has studied at Cambridge University and has an MBA from Stanford University, but that's only the beginning of her impressive work history, and I'm sure we'll hear more from her about it later on. So in this episode, we're going to talk about all about Tessa's journey and how she got to where she got to today. I've also asked Tessa to bring an admission submission, which is a really interesting one. Then we'll be discussing fundraising, women in tech, and the importance of diversity in business. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of I Shouldn't Say This, But. Jumping in then to the main topics of the podcast, it'd be great to hear a little about your life before Olio and then some of the things that got up to that point where you are today.
So when people say life before Olio, I kind of go, what life before Olio? Olio has been so all-consuming that it's hard to sort of dial back and remember that time before Olio. No recollection of my life is complete without starting with my upbringing at the very beginning. So my parents are farmers up in the northeast of England, and they still are. And my brother is sort of taking over the family farm. So I had a really rural upbringing, which immediately actually made me feel sort of quite different from everybody else. But at the time, sort of being a kid, you don't want to be different. You want to be the same as everybody else. So it was sometimes quite challenging. Whereas now, I look back and realize all the incredible things I've learned through spending my childhood on a farm. But yeah, I sort of lived at home and, on the farm until I was 21. And then I had no clue what I wanted to do when I grew up, perhaps because I didn't have many role models other than farmers. And I knew I didn't want to be a farmer. So I then went off and became a strategy consultant, which is a great starter career if you don't know what you want to do. Go become a consultant and you get to experience lots of different industries, lots of different functions. To be honest, actually, after that, I still didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew that I wanted to do something, i.e. as opposed to just strategy and writing PowerPoint presentations and building very complicated Excel models. And so I moved over into industry, and then I've spent probably about 10 or 15 years, first of all in media, then in retail, then in financial services, always in the digital space and in general management roles.
Brilliant. And you kind of touched on it a little bit, but did you think you would ever start your own business?
No, is the honest answer. I'm definitely not one of those people who grew up, got a computer when I was 5 and coding at 8 and my first business at 10. Far from it. I look back now actually on why I didn't think that entrepreneurship was for me, because actually now that I've reflected more and understood who I am as a person, it's kind of actually blindingly obvious that I was going to want to become an entrepreneur. And the reason why I didn't, even though I was exposed to quite a lot of entrepreneurship, I lived for 2 years in the heart of Silicon Valley, was I think due to a lack of role models. It just didn't feel like it was for someone like me. And it was only once, I guess, I got old enough and I found a problem that I was angry enough about and that I couldn't see anyone else solving. Plus, I was lucky enough to have a brilliant friend of mine, Sasha, who wanted to become a co-founder with me. And that then gave me the courage and conviction to actually say, well, come on, let's give this a go. But even for the first year, I mean, it's only very recently that I even feel comfortable using the phrase entrepreneur in association with myself, because, you know, certainly for the first couple of years, you have no idea what you're doing. You just wing it a little bit.
I'm a big believer in you can't be what you can't see. And it's part of the reason why I do this. Because it doesn't come comfortably at all, like talking on stage, doing podcasts, things like that. It doesn't come naturally, but I've been pushed into it because I see the impact that it has when I do it. So
yeah,
completely can agree with that. Olio is an incredible business and an idea that you came up with in 2014. Do you want to tell the listeners a little bit about how that idea came about?
Yeah, so the idea for Olio came about through a seemingly inconsequential moment in my life. I was moving country with my family. And on moving day, the removal men said to me that I had to throw away all of our uneaten food. Now, obviously, because I was brought up on a farm, I have always had a pathological hatred for food waste. And so when they told me I had to throw away all our food, there was absolutely no way I was going to do that. So much to their irritation, I stopped packing and instead bundled up my, at the time, newborn baby and toddler and set out onto the streets clutching this food, hoping to give it away to this lady who was kind of always in this one spot outside our local supermarket. And for some reason, she wasn't there that day. I got very over emotional about the fact that I'd gone to all this effort to share this food when I shouldn't have done. The removal men were sort of waiting for me, tapping their watches. And so I got quite emotional about the fact that I'd failed to find this lady to give the food to her. So I went back to my apartment, and when the packing men weren't looking, I smuggled the non-perishable food into the bottom of my packing boxes. And that was the moment I can remember so vividly, just thinking, I can't believe the crazy lengths I'm having to go to avoid throwing this food away. I'm probably performing a criminal offence right now. But to me, it seemed even more criminal to put perfectly good food in a bin when I knew there was someone probably less than 100 metres away from me who would like it. The problem was they just didn't know about it. And I had at that point spent sort of 10 plus years working in the digital world. I knew there was an app for everything. And I couldn't believe there wasn't an app where I could just simply advertise my food and a neighbour could request it and pop around and pick it up.
So do you want to just explain the premise of it? Because I've got it and I've used it.
Yes, certainly. So now there is an app where you can advertise your food and your neighbours can request it and pop around and pick it up. So Olio exists to tackle the problem of food waste, specifically food waste in the home. And we do that by connecting people with their neighbours so that you can give away rather than throw away your spare food. So most people might not realise, but in a country like the UK, we throw away a third of all the food we produce, and over half of all that food waste actually takes place in the home. Most people assume that most food waste takes place at a retail store level, and that couldn't be further from the truth. We in our homes, we're responsible for half of all food waste. Retail stores generate just 2% of all food waste. And the reason for that is because we've got roughly 28 million households throwing away roughly 20% in the weekly shop, which collectively adds up to £14 billion worth of perfectly good food being tossed away every single year. And we exist to solve that problem, as I've said, by connecting people with their neighbours so you can give it away rather than throw it away. And how it works is really simple. It takes probably about 10 seconds to add something to the Olio app. You kind of snap a photo, add it to the app. Neighbours living nearby get an alert, letting them know that something new has been added near them. They can then browse the listings, request what they want, and pop around and pick it up.
Brilliant. And have you seen, like, with COVID and our world's getting smaller, have you seen an increase in people using Olio as a platform because of the better connectivity that we've had with our neighbours in the last 12 months?
In a word, yes. A massive, massive, massive yes. So last year, Olio grew fivefold, and we just saw this explosion in neighbourly sharing. Now, the first thing we did when the first lockdown happened was move really, really quickly and introduce a no contact pickup model. So what that means is that instead of handing it over sort of, you know, hand to hand on the doorstep, you needed to set something down outside a few moments before the person was due to arrive to pick it up. And we put clear messaging throughout the app, throughout the user journey, explaining how to share in a COVID safe way. And I think there's a number of reasons why we saw this really, really dramatic increase in growth. The first is that if you remember back to, must be about this time a year ago now, there were all those photographs showing empty supermarket shelves. And I think that for many people in the UK, that gave them a really, really visceral reminder of just how important food is. It's literally our life source. And it was quite frightening to see empty supermarket shelves and to worry about whether you could access food. And so overnight, that led to a step change in terms of how people think about food. So there was some research done by an organization called Hubbub, and that showed that over 50% of people said that they were valuing food more. And also sort of 50% plus were saying that they were, as a result, wasting food less. So our relationship with food for many people changed almost overnight as a result of COVID. I think the other thing that COVID did was, because so many people were now living and working from home, that meant that just very instinctively, people wanted to reach out and connect with their local community in a way that they just hadn't wanted to or had the time to before. And Olio's provides a really sort of easy and also safe way to connect and meet with your neighbours. Plus, I think we all recognised through the pandemic just how much suffering and hardship and hunger there is in our local communities. And so for a lot of people, you know, staying home to help didn't feel like quite enough. They wanted to do more. And so sharing their spare, both food and also other household items, so you can give away toiletries and cleaning products and books, clothes, toys via Olio as well. For a lot of people, that became a really powerful way for them to both connect with their local community and also help their neighbours. And then I think the third thing that happened was just a kind of, we had a bit of a nationwide Marie Kondo moment where people had that much more time and they were living at home. They just wanted to declutter and sort of just minimalize a little bit their lives. And again, Olio just provided a really fast way for you to pass stuff on and give it a second life.
Amazing. I'm going to move on to the admission submission. So before this podcast, we asked you to come armed with an admission submission. And this podcast is called I Shouldn't Say This But, because in each episode, I try and open up with honesty and talk about subjects that perhaps someone in my role as an MD would usually avoid. So I've talked about imposter syndrome, anxiety, fear of failure, plus many, many more. So Tessa, would you mind sharing with us your admission submission of something you probably shouldn't say, whether that's about struggles you faced during your career, a secret about your lockdown experience, or something you're trying to overcome? So I shouldn't say this, but.
And I wish I didn't have to say this, but when fundraising, I spend a lot of time thinking, what would I do if I were a man?
I can't wait to unpack this with you. So what has led you to think like this?
So many things. But first of all, let's start with the data before I then sort of share my personal experience. So obviously I'm co-founder of a female founded tech business. And like many tech startups, we have to raise capital in order to grow. And if you look at the data for the VC industry in the UK, but indeed worldwide, roughly 1% of all VC investment goes to female founded businesses, 89% goes to male-founded businesses, and the delta, so roughly 10%, goes to mixed teams. Those odds, when you're going out to raise financing, are extremely daunting. And then when you start to go into the research, I remember watching an incredible video by a lady called Dana Kanzi, and she's a Harvard Business School professor, and she uncovered how female founders are asked prevention questions by investors, which basically are questions that are all about kind of the downside. What happens if Google or Facebook move into your market? You know, will you really be able to achieve X, Y, and Z? How can this possibly happen? Sort of so prevention, so generally kind of more negative type questions, whereas male founders are asked promotion questions. How big can this be? How fast can we grow? And so what they found, though, and what she discovered was that actually both female and male investors asked the prevention questions to female founders. But the real insight was that to solve that problem as a female founder, you need to answer the prevention questions with a promotion response. So yeah, there's an awful lot kind of, I guess, around the data showing why, as a female founder, because of both conscious and unconscious biases, and because of a lack of diversity amongst the gatekeepers of capital, your odds of being successful are really slim. And so I would find myself, when I'm preparing our pitch, thinking, okay, if I were a man, you know, men are successful at this. So if I were a man, how would I be presenting this? What story would I be telling? In what order? In what way? And, you know, what numbers would I be sharing? And I think even around the numbers piece, what women instinctively would present as their financial projections are often quite different than what men present. So yeah, I was constantly having to sort of double guess and double guess myself on that.
Do you think that's down to a safety thing? Do you think we're a lot more pragmatic and then men are a bit more ambitious? Like we'd go with the number we think we can achieve, whereas men would over egg.
Totally. Yeah. So women, and I say these are massive, broad, sweeping statements. Okay. So this is only about kind of the average. Of course, there's massive outliers for both genders, but women broadly tend to under-promise and over-deliver. And I think often for men, sort of, it's the other way around. And so, you know, a real example of this was on one of our early raises, the night before we were going to be kind of doing our first presentation with our first deck. And I sat there asking myself, what would a man do? I just thought, I need to double my numbers. And I literally just doubled the numbers in that presentation. And I think that was absolutely critical to enabling us to successfully raise financing.
And you've done it so well, haven't you? You've raised millions in investment.
Yeah.
What is the experience like when you go into those rooms? Do you get those questions? Did you notice the correlation between that research?
Totally. I can remember I'd sort of barely recently had watched that video. And then I think it was sort of the next day I got an email back from an investor in response to our pitch that we'd done. And every single line of that email was prevention question, prevention question, prevention question, prevention question. It was truly remarkable. So yes, it does happen the whole time. But one of the things that Sasha and I did fairly early on in our fundraising, I think it's really important to understand the reality of the situation you're going into and be open and honest about it. And whilst it can be horribly depressing, at least once you know the truth, you can then try and do something about it. And so one of the things that we did was we changed the order of our deck, and our very first slide was our own sort of personal credentials, because we had some badges of approval from institutions that we knew these investors would respect and respond to. And we thought, let's put that up front using the logos to enforce upon these investors, you need to take us seriously. And I think that was quite a powerful little tip.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Trick for us to use.
And I really like what you said earlier as well about answering that question with a growth answer. So really like flipping it and not going prevention, thinking growth.
Yeah.
There's a lot, isn't there, that you've got to think about then before you even... So as a female founder or a female, like as an entrepreneur, as a woman, you've then got to overanalyze how you're going to do things before you even go in the room.
Correct, yeah. And I think another thing that I found is that our sort of conversion rate, if you like, of female investors was north of 75%, and our conversion rate of male investors was perhaps 5 to 10% tops. And so what I discovered is that to get a maximum return on investment on our time, to increase our probability of success, I really need to focus on firms that, when you go on their About Us or the team webpage, it isn't just pale, male, and stale staring back at you. It's actually a really diverse team. And I knew that if a business had a diverse team, then our probability of success was going to be significantly higher than if they didn't.
So a great tip again there would be to go through a couple of these meetings, understand the data of what you're getting back, and then try and find the right investors that fit with the pattern that you've noticed for your investment previously. It's fascinating.
Yeah, and what I have found is that when I do find those investors who sort of get it, who tend to be the more diverse investors, and not just by gender, by the way, kind of all metrics of diversity, fundraising, and I, you know, men often kind of say how they enjoy kind of fundraising. It's fun because actually when you're being asked a whole load of promotion questions, it is really fun. And when you're asked a whole load of prevention questions, it is a brutal, miserable, soul-destroying experience. And when on occasion, and you know, these are the investors that are sat on our cap table now, and meet diverse investors, they tend to start asking you promotion questions. And it's just, it's a revelation. It's so much more energizing because you're talking to someone who gets it and you can start kind of co-creating the future.
I could talk to you about that for hours, but I think we would go on about it, but I'd love to pick your brains more on it. Has your mindset changed over time then when you're taking on investment?
Yeah.
I know you've talked about finding the right one, but has anything else changed in terms of how you approach it?
Yeah, a couple of things I'd say. The first is truly acknowledging and trying to find some peace with the fact that hearing no, 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 no is just an integral part of the experience. And so rather than taking it as a personal rejection of myself and my business, I try and just kind of step back and be quite philosophical about it and say, this is part of the journey, this comes with the territory, and I need lots and lots of no's to get to the yeses. I'm still a long way away from actually necessarily always being able to live that in practice, but on my more sort of measured days, I can really sort of get that. And then I think the other thing is that over the years, I've just started investing more and more time during the working day into my own well-being. I now no longer feel kind of guilty taking the first hour, hour and a half of the working day to go for a walk, go for a run, go for a bike ride, because I now recognize that that is critical for my well-being, for my performance. And even though it doesn't look like I'm working, I'm actually just doing lots of things that are incredibly beneficial to myself and to the business. And that's really helped me through the sort of dark, dark days of fundraising.
It is so true. I was listening to Jay Shetty's podcast, one of the most recent ones he's done, about how to be very efficient and really good at your job without burning out. And that was exactly what he said. Figure out what it is that you need in your day that will make you perform better in your job. Because
yeah,
there was a feeling of guilt, wasn't there? If you were taking time out to do exercise, you felt guilty that you weren't actually doing your job.
Yeah.
But I've had exactly the same journey this year. I'm a bit at home. I found that I can do things in a different way and it's got a better output.
It has. And I think also for me, the real breakthrough was recognizing that I needed to schedule that activity into the working day. Because the problem is if you leave it till the end of the day, you're just so tired. 9 times out of 10, you just don't end up getting around to it. And then you feel dreadful about it. Or if you do it sort of at the beginning, you know, sort of you end up getting up at the crack of dawn to try and do something, which means you're compromising your sleep, which has a negative impact on your well-being. And so, yeah, for me, it's just really, really powerful hack, which is schedule it during the day and don't be apologetic about it.
Definitely. And schedule it before you schedule your work. That's the other thing he said as well, is make sure that's the first thing you do, which I'd never thought of it in that way, because I always try, obviously as a people pleaser as I am, I try and just do everything for everyone. But that mind shift change really got me thinking. So we've talked a little bit about women in tech and you've talked about the statistics around venture capital investment. I want to pick a little bit more into women in tech and the importance of diversity in business, if that's okay. What do you think of the term female founder?
I think that we need female founders to solve the world's biggest problems. And the lack of female founders to date has meant that too many enormous problems have been left unsolved, whilst lots of, relatively speaking, unimportant problems have received crazy amounts of funding. So I really think that humanity needs female founders, and also sort of, you know, I don't like nowadays actually talking just about female founders. I think it's really important to talk about diverse founders across all sort of metrics of diversity. So that those stats that I shared with you about the terrible odds facing female founders, the Black founders, for example, face equally shockingly poor odds of getting fundraising. And I'm getting increasingly angry about that, because when I look out into the world and I look at the problems that need solving, the people who I see that are trying to solve it are diverse founders, and they are undercapitalized. And what that means is that humanity is being shortchanged massively, because we're not solving the real problems.
We have to look at it within social chain, because being marketeers and working in a field where you can target anybody, I don't think it's right to have one viewpoint, because you're never going to get the right campaign, right ideas come out of the same people every time when you're trying to target different people. That's not going to work for everyone, and ideas are going to come from places because of different experiences.
Yeah, we have Olio's number one company value is inclusive, and that's really deliberate, because we want to build a product that's for 1 billion people, because that is what we have to achieve if humanity stand any chance whatsoever of mitigating the worst effects of the climate crisis. So if we want to build a product that works for 1 billion people, then we need to have a team who reflect as best we can 1 billion people. And that's really, really important to us, and has really shaped how we have built and grown the business. And I believe it has resulted in us building a much stronger business than if we weren't so diverse.
And do you see that reflected in your user data as well?
Yeah, our user data actually across most metrics is very representative of the population as a whole. The only metric where we noticeably differ from the UK population is on gender. So roughly 2/3 of our user base is female. But in terms of ethnicity and age and sociodemographics, we're pretty representative of the population as a whole.
Does that match with female shoppers though? Because I think household female, even though that is an old term.
No, totally. I think it's women intuitively get what we're trying to do at Olio, because still, even in this day and age, women are still broadly responsible for the kitchen and feeding the family and doing that kind of delicate balance of managing that kind of supply and demand of food through your fridge.
And I know we just said about diverse founders and the importance of that, but what do you think are the top three problems that diverse founders but female founders face, and why?
The number one problem is lack of access to capital. You know, we are not given the capital or the permission to dream big, to solve important problems. So I would almost place that in positions number one, two, and three, because when I think about my own performance and I look at the other female founders that I see, they are all kind of significantly above average in terms of performance. The only thing that is holding them back, the only time they ever think of themselves as being a female founder, is when that label is put on them, when they're not treated equally, when they're trying to go raise financing. I think the only other thing, if I had to say something, but again, lots of female founders are solving this, is in terms of, I guess, the cultural norm that businesses need to take place, or business needs to take place in an office. And that has, I think, made founding a business really hard for a number of women, and certainly pre-COVID. Perhaps if you didn't have an office like us at Olio, we've always been a remote first business, because Sasha and I both had young kids. It made no sense at all to waste a lot of money on an expensive office that neither of us wanted to be in. But that ended up actually having to be a kind of our dirty little secret, because a lot of these, you know, kind of broadly male investors could not get their heads around us being able to work effectively and not be in an office. And I do think that thankfully now COVID has showed everybody that that is possible, and actually we're much more efficient in many ways when working from home. And so I'm really hopeful actually that this will unleash a massive wave of female foundership, because that old stereotype has been sort of broken down a little bit, and you absolutely can start a business from your home.
Amazing. I really hope so as well. What do you think investors can do then to make it easier for women who are raising capital?
They need to significantly diversify the most senior levels of their organization. So a lot of good steps have been made with regards to bringing in female associates, so at the lower level, and diverse associates. But unfortunately, they do not have check writing abilities, and you're still then going to a very non-diverse investment committee. And the number of times we have had a really passionate female analyst, associate, principal even, who really gets what we're doing, they are then battling against that lack of diversity at their investment committee level. And so their investments are not getting made. So if I had a sort of a magic wand, I think that entrepreneurship would be solved or made dramatically more diverse and effective overnight if we had diverse investment committees.
I feel like I want to go and like start some sort of stand against it, because it's holding back so many opportunities for people.
It's heartbreaking, but it's also deeply infuriating to see these brilliant businesses not get funding. And then you see the volumes of capital just being thrown into stuff. You know, my current sort of bugbear, and forgive me, is, you know, the hundreds of millions and billions of investment that is going into the what's called quick commerce, so get your groceries in less than 10 minutes. My take on that is solving a sort of a non-problem problem for the 1%. And yet I see all these amazing startups that are tackling real problems for humanity with diverse founders, and they're sort of scrabbling around to get breadcrumbs of investment. And that's, you know, if you kind of step back and look at society and humanity overall, the current system makes no sense at all. We're investing in a whole load of stuff that doesn't really matter.
So to wrap it all up then, because I think I honestly feel like I could talk to you forever, but I know you're very busy. My final question is, from all the points we've discussed and from your experience and the fact that we all hope that there's going to be a lot more diverse founders started throughout COVID, and then also a change within that sort of investor level, what advice would you give to our listeners who are maybe on that beginning part of their journey?
I would give a couple of book recommendations, actually. So the first one is to read a book called The Mom Test by Rob Fitzpatrick, which is a really, really short but incredibly powerful book that helps you through that critical early phase of when you are trying to get market research feedback on your idea. So that's mandatory reading number one. And mandatory reading number two is a book called The Lean Startup by Eric Ries. And that outlines the whole philosophy of just getting something launched as quickly as possible, no matter how crap it is, get that user feedback and iterate. So that kind of test, measure, learn loop, and doing it as quickly as possible. Because again, actually, if there's anything horrific gender stereotypes, I think often a lot of women want to perfect something far too much before putting it out in the open. And you read that book and you realize that that is just totally the wrong way to go about it. You've just got to get it out, get it into the hands of the users, stop trying to second guess what people want, get real feedback, and then respond to it really, really quickly. And then the third thing I guess I'd say is listen to podcasts. You know, Sasha and I have done really sort of a mini MBA or even a full MBA just listening to podcasts and learning from others. And I wrote a blog post actually on Medium, which just pulled together, I think, about 20 startup-focused podcasts, which we found absolutely invaluable on our journey.
Brilliant. We'll have to share that as well. But I just want to say a massive thank you. You've highlighted some things to me that I wasn't aware of. And I know that a lot of the listeners are ambitious, young, majority female with some male in there as well, who I know will have taken so much from our conversation today. I wish you the best of luck with it. And I think it's an incredible product, an incredible brand. And yeah, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
It has been an absolute pleasure to speak to Tessa today, and I know I've learned a lot from her. If you want to connect with Tessa, please drop her a message on LinkedIn, where I'm sure she'd be happy to answer your questions. Otherwise, I will be back with another episode of I Shouldn't Say This But next week.